the biggest ramifications were the closure of most of the village facilities, including the clinic.
A Fairbanks woman is sentenced for mishandling tribal funds. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the oil industry spends millions of dollars avoiding polar bear dens on the North Slope each winter.
And so the bear's body heat and breath and everything in there is creating this nice strong signature, allows us to identify where it is.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
And by
Full Circle, delivering organic produce and groceries across Alaska since 2006, featuring fresh pasta, coffee, fish, and baked items from Alaskan producers. More at fullcircle.com/APRN.
President Obama delivered his final budget to Congress this morning. It has a picture of Denali on the cover and several big-ticket Alaska items among its pages. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Deputy Interior Secretary Mike Connor told reporters the budget includes a proposed 10-year, $2 billion coastal climate resilience program to help states and communities adapt to climate change.
Part of this funding is set aside to address the needs that the president saw firsthand when he visited coastal communities in Alaska that are seeing their homelands eroding into the ocean at a rapid pace.
Alaska's share of the climate fund would be $400 million over a decade. The budget also includes $150 million toward a new billion-dollar icebreaker. The White House says the money would complete all planning and design work so ship construction could begin in 2020. Obama also wants to boost Denali Commission funding to $19 million and, says USGS boss Suzette Kimball, improve Alaska data collection to create better maps.
It is particularly critical for Alaska, as many of the existing Alaska topographic maps are as much as 50 years old.
The budget aims to lower the nation's carbon emissions, in part by squeezing the oil industry. To fund a greener transportation system, the president is proposing a new per-barrel oil tax of $10.25. Alaska's oil industry and congressional delegation call that a terrible idea. The budget would also eliminate tax breaks that save the oil and gas industry more than $2 billion a year. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell says oil has an unfair advantage over alternatives.
It is not a level playing field across the energy landscape, and this budget attempts to make it at least a little more level.
A president's budget is only a proposal, but it usually influences how Congress writes spending bills. This year, congressional leaders are harshly critical. Alaska's delegation to Congress says they like the icebreaker money but dislike the oil tax, among other items. Congressman Don Young, in a written statement, called the budget frustrating because, Young says, it identifies problems of great concern to many Alaskans but fails to provide a genuine path to solve them. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
President Obama signed the Coast Guard Authorization Act last night, transferring 2,500 acres of federal land at Port Clarence to local, state, and federal stakeholders. Located 120 nautical miles northwest of Nome, Port Clarence has been discussed as the location for the nation's Arctic deep draft port. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski said in a press release, "This land transfer is one of the first steps in making Alaska a leader in the Arctic. Bering Straits Native Corporation is the main recipient of the land transfer." In a press release by Bering Straits CEO Gail Schubert, she said, "Last week, this land transfer will move the region toward a promising Arctic future." A Fairbanks woman is facing 90 days home confinement and 3 years probation for mishandling federal funds meant for a local tribe. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, the Healy Lake tribe says it will take months before it can recover.
On Friday, U.S. District Court Judge Ralph Beistlein sentenced Joanne Polston after she pled guilty to misappropriating more than $100,000 of federal funds meant for the Healy Lake tribe. U.S. Attorney Yvonne Lamore says at the time, Polston was first chief and tribal administrator for the tribe.
She was writing checks to herself and transferring money from the tribe's bank accounts to her personal bank accounts for her own personal use.
Lamore says along with the 90-day home confinement and 3-year probation, Polston is also ordered to work with the tribe to restore the stolen funds. Attorney Mike Wallery represents the Healy Lake Tribe. He says for a small tribal entity, $100,000 is a big deal.
The biggest ramification was the closure of most of the village facilities, including the clinic, the community center, the washateria and well house, as well as the tribal office buildings in the village.
Wallery says in the year or so since Polston was removed from office, the tribe has slowly reopened buildings and partially restored services. He says, with luck, the tribe will be back on its feet by December. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
When the tundra freezes, the North Slope gets busy. That's the time of year when oil companies can put in an ice road or finish construction. But before any of that can happen, one task comes first: looking for polar bears. As changing sea ice has sent more polar bears ashore in the winter, APRN's Rachel Waldholt spoke to the guys who try to keep bears and people apart.
Okay, take a left 90, please.
Justin Blank and Steve Wachowski are on the hunt. They're looking for polar bears.
And go ahead and sweep left.
On the North Slope, bears have the right of way. Each winter, pregnant females dig out dens in snowdrifts and settle in to give birth. And federal regulations require all human activities to remain at least a mile away. That means every winter, millions of dollars of work on the North Slope must be routed around any known dens. And that's where Blank and Wachowski come in.
You can go ahead and cook through this. There's nothing there.
The pair work for the company Fairweather, which has carved out a niche providing unconventional services for oil and gas companies, from remote medics to polar bear guards. Early each winter, Blank and Wachowski fly surveys on the North Slope, looking for dens near any planned projects.
I'm not seeing any snowdrifts here.
No, keep coming. There's one other potential spot it's showing.
They do this using an infrared camera. At his Anchorage office, Blank points out a photo.
Here's a picture of the camera. It looks like R2-D2 upside down, right?
The camera rotates on the underside of the plane, controlled by a joystick.
Oh, really? It looks like a video game controller.
Well, I tell my mom this. You always told me that video games wouldn't help me in life, and you were wrong, Mom.
The sensor picks up heat. It can sense just a fraction of a degree difference, and the images it produces look like black and white TV. White means hot, and warmer regions, like a road or a river, show up as bright spots in a muddy gray landscape. Tracks where a vehicle or even a bear has passed will linger days later, just slightly warmer than the surrounding snow. But it takes a trained eye to know what you're seeing. Blank is one of the only people outside the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service who's good enough to identify a den.
And what you're seeing there is a vent hole. And so the bear's body heat and breath and everything in there is creating this nice, strong signature, allows us to identify where it is.
Wachowski says it's almost impossible to see.
It glows like an orb and it catches your eye. But, you know, when you're in an airplane and you're on hour 3 and been looking for 3 hours of black and white video, everything kind of blends together, right?
The pair will fly for 3 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the afternoon, averaging 800 miles a day for a couple weeks. And most days, they won't find anything. In a big year, Blank says, he'll log maybe 8 suspected dens total. That's a lot of time and expense for 8 polar bears. But Blank says, for companies on the slope, it's worth it. If a den turns up in the way of an ice road, it's the ice road that has to move. That's time-consuming and costly. And all those hours in the air mean that when you do find something, it's pretty exciting.
Is that it?
This is Wachowski's 34th birthday this past December.
Oh, tell me I found my first den. There's tracks there. There's a hole.
That's a good maybe, man.
Wachowski actually learned to operate infrared sensors flying unmanned vehicles in Iraq and Afghanistan for the Air Force. The technology the team uses was originally developed by the military to see at night.
For me, I go back to, I'm using some of the skills I learned in the military to go find bad guys, and now I get to use it to protect wildlife at home and these incredible critters that, you know, we share the environment with.
He says it's a fulfilling mission, and that mission has gotten more important in recent years because there are more bears than ever denning on shore.
The pattern of polar bear denning has completely reversed itself within a matter of a few decades.
Christopher Putnam oversees the den surveys for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. 30 years ago, 2/3 of southern Beaufort Sea polar bears denned on sea ice. Now, 2/3 are denning on shore. And that means more contact with people, both local communities and the oil industry. And why is that? What's driving them inland?
Who knows? There's something about the sea ice they don't like.
Putnam says bears usually den where there's jumble ice to catch snowdrifts. It might be that those spots aren't stable enough anymore to last through the 3 or so months of the denning season. But he says one thing is clear.
This is one of the observable impacts of climate change that it's not a model, it's not a prediction. We're seeing it happen.
Back at Fairweather, Blank pulls up one last video.
And that spot, is that a bear?
That is an actual bear.
That looks like a bear.
Yep.
It shows a big, empty, gray field with one bright white spot, a bear, loping along over the landscape alone.
You know, at this point, we're nearly a mile away from her, so she's the technology is good enough that we can see these things from far, far away. Don't have to compete on the bear.
Oh, that's so cool. She's just sort of strolling along there.
Yeah. But this bear will stay out and just try and make a living all winter.
Hopefully without running into many people. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, as the Yukon Quest enters the halfway point, mushers talk strategy.
We know what he's doing all the time. He don't know what we're doing, so I like it that way.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Applying for food stamps or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program requires a 28-page application. But thanks to a new tool, finding out if you're likely to be eligible takes only 10 text messages. KSKA's Urban Affairs reporter Ann Hillman has the story.
About 126,000 Alaskans are eligible to receive food stamps. But 27% of them, that's 34,000 people, don't, because they haven't applied. Anchorage resident Brendan Babb sees that as a problem, not just for the families who may be struggling, but for the state's entire economy.
It'd be $65 million coming from the federal government into local communities, because the money has an economic multiplying effect, and it's spent in the communities that people receive it in. So it would impact Anchorage as well as very small rural villages.
Babb and a group of volunteers from Code for Anchorage thought the daunting application was part of the problem.
If you go and look at a 28-page PDF, you're like, oh, I'll do this later. I'm guilty of doing this. Like, if something doesn't load, if a web page doesn't load in 30 seconds, I'm like, oh, I'll come back and do that.
So they developed a fast solution. Instead of filling out the whole application, you can answer 10 questions over text messages. You don't need the internet or a smartphone. At the end, the free service tells you if you're likely eligible or not and connects you to local resources like the Department of Public Assistance or local food pantries. You can even request help applying if you qualify. Code for Anchorage is working with MRelief, a tech company in Chicago, to provide the service. If you already have SNAP benefits, you can find out your balance via text and locate stores nearby that accept Quest cards. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Front runners in the Yukon Quest are running toward the race's halfway point at Dawson City, Yukon. Defending Quest champion Brent Sass continues to lead the race. The Eureka musher was in and out of the Eagle checkpoint first this morning after 4 hours of mandatory rest. He only briefly shared the dog yard with chasers Alan Moore and Hugh Neff, who arrived 2 hours after Sass. Fellow veterans Matt Hall and Ed Hopkins are also in the mix near the front of the race. Eagle is the only community on the 300 miles of trail between Circle and Dawson. And as KUAC's Molly Reddig reports, the historic Yukon River town offers race watchers a glimpse at teams traversing a remote stretch of trail.
Brent Sass pulled into Eagle at 4:30 a.m. under a pale streak of northern lights after mushing through the night on the Yukon River. He said the trail was fast.
Real fast. It was,
Yeah, it was nice.
He was greeted by a vet and a dozen volunteers in bright safety vests. Sass has blown through most checkpoints so far, so he gave an update of his first 360 miles.
It's been interesting. I've been struggling a little bit with some sick dogs.
After a lot of attention, he said they're feeling better.
The last two runs, they started eating a lot better, and their attitudes have come up.
On Monday, most of the mushers moved through Circle City, a village on the banks of the Yukon. Locals were out and about all day, dropping off snacks and cheering on teams. Alexander Adley said the Yukon Quest is the highlight of the year.
It's really good to see. It's just like the spring carnival of Circle City to see all these dogs and people come in there with all these dog trucks and everything.
When they got into Circle, mushers cruised down the street and made a sharp left turn into the checkpoint. More than 100 dogs were crammed into an area the size of a basketball court. Most were curled into tight balls, sleeping on piles of straw. After mushers spent an hour or so with their dogs, warming up food and massaging feet, they wandered into the fire hall in various stages of exhaustion.
I just keep telling myself, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake.
Early Monday morning, Seth Barnes collected food bowls after camping his dogs. Like most of the mushers, he was very impressed with the last 100 miles of trail on the way north to Circle.
No overflow on Birch Creek. I mean, it literally was perfect. Definitely the best trail I've been on all year.
His dogs come from Mitch Sheevy's kennel on the Kenai Peninsula. They've been training on gravel most of the winter, so he was really happy to get back in the snow.
Can we just do like 800 more miles of that trail?
It was about 25 below on the last stretch of Birch Creek coming into Circle. Barnes said his team was adapting well to the colder weather. Mushers grabbed soup, tortillas, and lasagna before finding a quiet spot to sleep for a few hours. Andy Pace, a rookie from Healy, was the seventh musher into Circle.
Oh, thank you.
He was clipping his dogs back to the line Monday afternoon after a 7-hour layover. Pace was excited for the next section of the race. From Circle, the trail follows the wide Yukon River as it snakes through low mountains. He's run the Quest 300 before, but never the full 1,000 miles to Whitehorse.
I've never been on the Yukon, so this is, I finally get to see it.
With his team lined out, he cruised out of the crowded dog yard and turned toward the empty river. The race changes once mushers get on the Yukon. They have to negotiate sections of jumble ice where other creeks pour into the river. Trail breakers have blasted a path through the ice, but it can still be really rough. Also, the checkpoints are farther apart, with much less support from handlers and volunteers.
You're going to be on your own.
Torsten Konert is a veteran musher from Sweden. He likes this part of the trail.
It's really nice. So really can focus just on the dogs and nothing else.
After leaving Circle, Alan Moore, Hugh Neff, and Matt Hall camped at Trout Creek as well. Two-time champion Moore was keeping an eye on Sass, who was doing a lot of long runs early in the race. He said he doesn't mind being behind him at this point.
We know what he's doing all the time, and he don't know what we're doing, so I like it that way.
In Eagle, the trail leaves the river and climbs American Summit. The next checkpoint is Dawson City, 144 miles away, where mushers take a mandatory 36-hour layover. On the Yukon Quest Trail in Eagle, I'm Molly Redig.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The renovated and enlarged Sitka Public Library is now open for business, with thousands of books having been moved back from temporary quarters on the Sheldon Jackson campus. Residents showed up in force to check out the new digs last week. KCAW's Brielle Schaefer has more.
Before the new Sitka Public Library opened its doors, it was just a big building full of books. A beautiful building, but still just a building. It didn't actually become a library until after the ceremonial ribbon cutting, when eager Sitkins streamed into the facility to get their first peek.
Welcome to opening night for the Sitka Public Library.
kids made beelines to the new children's area to check out puzzles and play in a see-through porthole. An elderly man found an atlas and a seat, pulling out his magnifying glass to get a better look. And people of all kinds lined up to check out books for the first time in a month.
Hey, Rob.
Hi.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Library director Rob Farmer was overwhelmed at the opening. The new library took a decade of planning, $6 million, and a year of construction.
This really shows what a library can be for a community, because everyone has a different need that we want to try to fill.
And the space really focuses on that. There's a teen lab with a digital fabrication area, electric guitar, and recording equipment. Nearby is a tween coloring corner. There's also a big computer lab, a children's play area, and lots of comfy couches for browsing. That's something Frank Barnes looks forward to.
Well, I'm looking at my spot. This is where I'll be because I can sit here and read the magazines and look out over the water. And that's what the old library had, and that's what the new library has.
Elizabeth Schaefer was also perusing books nearby.
I've been waiting for a long time to get in here and see what it looks like. I'm quite excited about seeing it. So far, I love it. It's bright and open and bigger.
The word of the night was excited. Pretty much everyone I talked to at the opening was enthusiastic about the new space. Assemblymember Ben Maiasato checked out the first books at the new library. He was pretty proud of this milestone. So, what's he reading?
Life by Keith Richards. It's a good book. He's a good read. The guy's still around.
His second choice was decidedly less rock and roll, a biographical volume about Winston Churchill.
Not light reading. This book is 800 pages almost.
Something else he was pleased with? The celebratory cookies.
For today on this grand reopening, we get to eat in the library.
Other patrons were getting their literary fixes too, either returning overdue books or finding new ones to check out at the busy opening. Here's Khalil McCormick, Courtney MacArthur, and Bill Davis.
Pete the Cat.
Shades of Grey, not to be confused with 50 Shades of Grey, by Jasper Ford.
Are you going to check anything out tonight?
Not tonight, no. I'll check out my wife if I can find her.
Library Director Farmer seemed to be basking in all the craziness of the event, leading one customer to the paperback section and fielding lots of questions. Some people may say libraries are dying, he says, but they're not. They're just evolving to fit into the increasingly digital world.
Libraries are for the exchange of information of all different kinds.
And in that sense, with the backdrop of excited conversations, a bustling circulation counter, and satisfied patrons, the Sitka Public Library is more alive than ever. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Brielle Schaefer.
Kill the Indian, save the man. That's the name of a provocative new exhibit at the Anchorage Museum by Sitka-based artist Nicholas Galanin, one of three to recently open. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, each show is strong on its own, but together the three exhibits explore what modern art means today in Alaska.
So they're clear ballistic torsos that we lined up and shot.
Can we go up? Can we look at? A few hours before his first solo show at the museum is set to start, Nicholas Galanin walks past workmen and collaborators putting the final touches on an array of installations spanning from a performance piece to taxidermy. He stops in front of a multidisciplinary piece called A Supple Plunder. A projector shows slow-motion footage of a bullet ripping through ballistic gel. Beneath are nine clear human torsos that'll be stacked on pedestals like classical busts.
Nine Unungan men were bound together, or 12 were bound together and shot to see how far a bullet would penetrate, and the ninth dropped. All nine dropped. So this is our visual busts created to honor those men.
The incident is cited as one of the atrocities during Russian colonization in the Aleutian Islands during the 1760s. Galanin's collaborator for the piece was his brother, Jared, who says it was an emotional experience recreating the grim history the work draws from in the artistic process.
It's easy to do that with a torso without any head. And I can only imagine the Russian that did this probably laughed too and thought it was funny. And I don't understand that. I don't know how you get to that point where you can do that.
The idea of having collaborators in a solo show is just one of the many gestures Galanin and his partners weave into the exhibit, which has been in the works for about a year. Altogether, the pieces are an arresting mix of conceptual criticism, technical finesse, and beauty that verges at times on the grotesque. One of Galanin's co-creators, interdisciplinary artist Nep Sidhu, says all the works are bound together by the show's theme.
Hence the idea of kill the Indian, save the man. It's an impossible notion.
Sidhu and Galanin are both part of Black Constellation, a collective of artists stretching across the West Coast and parts of Canada. Together, the artists dressed four mannequins in an opulent but unsettling mix of garments. One wears a Chilkat robe over a cascade of winter jackets, a comment, Sidhu says, on the epidemic of missing Indigenous women in Canada.
You know, looking at a lot of missing persons reports, you would often come across the one thing that they had in common was winter jackets. You know, last seen wearing a red winter parka, winter jackets over and over.
Using traditional and Indigenous artistic forms, like a Chilkat robe, to make a statement about the present is hardly revolutionary. But the Anchorage Museum is taking big steps to collapse any distinction between those traditional forms and modern art with a big M.
I think those boundaries feel very arbitrary now, and maybe putting all of the voices together and saying this is Alaska's media and these are the artists that are working here feels better.
That's Julie Decker, the museum's curator, standing in front of works that are part of the all-new All Alaska Biennale. Calling it new isn't quite accurate. The Biennale was created by combining two shows that for decades have been distinct. In the past, the All Alaska Juried Exhibition was for so-called modern artworks like formal painting and sculpture. And on alternate years, the Earth, Fire, and Fiber Show assembled masterworks from so-called traditional forms like weaving and ceramics. But Decker says the museum is experimenting in how it sees and supports a shifting definition of modern within the arts.
So I think art is changing, the way we define media is changing, and all artists are working and experimenting in a lot of different forms. And so this is a survey of contemporary art of this place at this time.
The two shows, plus another solo exhibit by Anchorage artist Mike Conti that looks critically at the culture around ice hockey, are all on display at the museum through April 10th. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Emily Russell in Nome, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes, also in Anchorage, Brielle Schaefer in Sitka, and Molly Reddick on the Yukon Quest Trail. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deedline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.